Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. Under an evolving plan, Washington wanted the Saudis to guarantee to maintain oil supplies and prices at levels that could fluctuate, but that would always remain acceptable to the United States and our allies. If other countries such as Iran, Iraq, Indonesia, or Venezuela threatened embargoes, Saudi Arabia, with its vast petroleum supplies, would step in to fill the gap. Simply the knowledge that they might do so would, in the long run, discourage other countries from even considering an embargo. In exchange for this guarantee, Washington would offer the House of Saud an amazingly attractive deal, a commitment to provide total and unequivocal U.S. political and, if necessary, military support, thereby ensuring their continued existence as the rulers of their country. It was a deal the House of Saud could hardly refuse, given its geographic location, lack of military might, and general vulnerability to neighbors like Iran, Syria, Iraq, and Israel. Naturally, Washington used its advantage to impose one other critical condition, a condition that redefined the role of economic hitmen in the world and served as a model we would later attempt to apply in other countries, most notably in Iraq. In retrospect, John sometimes finds it difficult to understand how Saudi Arabia could have accepted this condition. Certainly, most of the rest of the Arab world, OPEC and other Islamic countries, were appalled when they discovered the terms of the deal and the manner in which the royal house capitulated to Washington's demands. The condition was that Saudi Arabia would use its petrodollars to purchase U.S. government securities. In turn, the interest earned by the securities would be spent by the U.S. Department of the Treasury in in ways that enabled Saudi Arabia to emerge from a medieval society into the modern industrialized world. In other words, the interest compounding on billions of dollars of the kingdom's oil income would be used to pay U.S. companies to fulfill the vision John and presumably some of his competitors had come up with to convert Saudi Arabia into a modern industrial power. The U.S. Department of Treasury would hire John's and companies like his at Saudi expense to build infrastructure projects and even entire cities throughout the Arabian Peninsula. Although the Saudis reserved the right to provide input regarding the general nature of these projects, the reality was that an elite core of foreigners, mostly infidels in the eyes of the Muslims, would determine the future appearance and economic makeup of the Arabian Peninsula. And this would occur in a kingdom founded on conservative Wahhabi principles and run according to those principles for several centuries. It seemed a huge leap of faith on their part, yet under the circumstances and due to the political and military pressures undoubtedly brought to bear by Washington, John suspected the Saud family felt they had few alternatives. From John's perspective, the prospects for immense profits seemed limitless. It was a sweetheart deal with potential to set an amazing precedent. And to make the deal even sweeter, no one had to obtain congressional approval, a process loathed by corporations, particularly privately owned ones like Bechtel and Maine, which prefer not to open their books or share their secrets with anyone. Thomas W. Lipman, an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute and a former journalist, eloquently summarizes the salient points of this deal. The Saudis, rolling in cash, would deliver hundreds of millions of dollars to Treasury, which held on to the funds until they were needed to pay vendors or employees. This system assured that the Saudi money would be recycled back into the American economy. It also ensured that the commission's managers could undertake whatever projects they and the Saudis agreed were useful without having to justify them to Congress. Close quote. Establishing the parameters for this historic undertaking took less time than anyone could have imagined. After that, however, there had to be ways determined to implement it. To set the process in motion, someone at the highest level of government was dispatched to Saudi Arabia, an extremely confidential mission. John never knew for sure, but he believes the envoy was Henry Kissinger. Whoever the envoy was, his first job was to remind the royal family about what had happened in neighboring Iran when Mossadegh tried to oust British petroleum interests. Next, he would outline a plan that would be too attractive for them to turn down, in effect conveying to the Saudis that they had few alternatives. John has no doubt that they were left with a distinct impression that they could either accept the offer and thus gain assurances that the U.S. would support and protect them as rulers, or they could refuse and go the way of Mossadegh. When the envoy returned to Washington, he brought with him the message that the Saudis would like to comply. There was just one slight obstacle. The U.S. would have to convince key players in the Saudi government. This was a family matter. Saudi Arabia was not a democracy, and yet it seemed that within the House of Saud, there was a need for consensus. In 1975, John was assigned to one of those key players. He always thought of him as Prince W, although he never determined that the prince was actually a crown prince. John's job was to persuade him that the Saudi Arabia money laundering affair would benefit his country as well as him personally. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. This was not as easy as it first appeared. Prince W. professed himself a good Wahhabi and insisted that he did not want to see his country follow in the footsteps of Western commercialism. He also claimed that he understood the insidious nature of what was being proposed. The U.S., he said, had the same objectives as the Crusaders a millennium earlier, the Christianization of the Arab world. In fact, he was partially right about this. In John's opinion, the difference between the Crusaders and the U.S. was a matter of degree. Europe's medieval Catholics claimed their goal was to save Muslims from purgatory. The U.S. claimed that it wanted to help the Saudis modernize. In truth, John believes the Crusaders, like the corporatocracy, were primarily seeking to expand their empire. Religious beliefs aside, Prince W. had one weakness: for beautiful blondes. It seems almost ludicrous to mention what has now become an unfair stereotype, and John should mention that Prince W. was the only man among many Saudis he knew who had this proclivity, or at least the only one who was willing to let John see it. Yet it played a role in structuring the historic deal, and it demonstrates how far John would go to complete his mission. From the start, Prince W. let John know that whenever the prince came to visit John in Boston, he expected to be entertained by a woman of his liking, and that he expected her to perform many functions, more functions than those of a simple escort. But he most definitely did not want a professional call girl, someone he or his family members might bump into on the street or at a cocktail party. John's meetings with Prince W. were held in secret, which made it easier for John to comply with his wishes. Sally was a beautiful blue-eyed blonde who lived in the Boston area. Her husband, a United Airlines pilot who traveled a great deal both on and off the job, made little attempt to hide his infidelities. Sally had a cavalier attitude about her husband's activities. She appreciated his salary, the plush Boston condo, and the benefits a pilot's spouse enjoyed in those days. A decade earlier, she had been a hippie who had been accustomed to promiscuous sex, and she found the idea of a secret source of income attractive. She agreed to give Prince W. a try on one condition. She insisted that the future of their relationship depended entirely upon his behavior and attitude towards her. Fortunately for John, each met the other's criteria. The Prince W.-Sally affair, a subchapter of the Saudi Arabian money laundering affair, created its own set of problems for John. Maine strictly prohibited its partners from doing anything illicit. From a legal standpoint, John was procuring sex, pimping, an illegal activity in Massachusetts, and so the main problem was figuring out how to pay for Sally's services. Luckily, the accounting department allowed John great liberties with his expense account. He was a good tipper, and he managed to persuade waiters in some of the most posh restaurants in Boston to provide him with blank receipts. It was an era when people, not computers, filled out receipts. Prince W. grew bolder as time went by. Eventually, he wanted John to arrange for Sally to come and live in his private cottage in Saudi Arabia. This was not an unheard-of request in those days. There was an active trade in young women between certain European countries and the Middle East. These women were given contracts for some specified period of time, and when the contract expired, they went home to a very substantial bank account. Robert Baer, a case officer in the CIA's Directorate of Operations for 20 years, and a specialist in the Middle East sums it up. In the early 1970s, when the petrodollars started flooding in, enterprising Lebanese began smuggling hookers into the kingdom for the princes. Since no one in the royal family knows how to balance a checkbook, the Lebanese became fabulously wealthy. John was familiar with this situation and even knew people who could arrange such contracts. However, for him, there were two major obstacles, Sally and the payment. John was certain Sally was not about to leave Boston and move to a desert mansion in the Middle East. It was also pretty obvious that no collection of blank restaurant receipts would cover this expense. Prince W. took care of the latter concern by assuring John that he expected to pay for his new mistress himself. John was only required to make the arrangements. It also gave John great relief when he went on to confide that the Saudi Arabian Sally did not have to be the exact same person as the one who had kept him company in the United States. John made calls to several friends who had Lebanese contacts in London and Amsterdam. Within a couple of weeks, a surrogate Sally signed a contract. Prince W. was a complex person. Sally satisfied a corporeal desire, and John's ability to help the prince in this regard earned him his trust. However, it by no means convinced the prince that Sama was a strategy he wanted to recommend for his country. John had to work very hard to win his case. He spent many hours showing the prince statistics and helping him analyze studies John had undertaken for other countries, including econometric models he had developed for Kuwait while training with Claudine during those first few months before heading to Indonesia. Eventually, the prince relented. John was not familiar with the details of what went on between his fellow economic hitmen and the other key Saudi players. All John knows is that the entire package was finally approved by the royal family. Maine was rewarded for its part with one of the first highly lucrative contracts administered by the U.S. Department of the Treasury. They were commissioned to make a complete survey of the country's disorganized and outmoded electrical system and to design a new one that would meet standards equivalent to those in the United States. As usual, it was John's job to send in the first team to develop economic and electrical load forecasts for each region of the country. Three of the men who worked for John, all experienced in international projects, were preparing to leave when word came down from their legal department that under the terms of the contract, they were obligated to have a fully equipped office up and running within the next few weeks. This clause had apparently gone unnoticed for over a month. Their agreement with the Treasury further stipulated that all equipment had to be manufactured either in the United States or in Saudi Arabia. Since Saudi Arabia did not have factories for producing such items, everything had to be sent from the United States. To their chagrin, they discovered that long lines of tankers were queued up, waiting to get into ports on the Arabian Peninsula. It could take many months to get a shipment of supplies to the kingdom. Maine was not about to lose such a valuable contract over a couple of rooms of office furniture. At a conference of all the partners involved, they brainstormed for several hours. The solution they settled on was to charter a Boeing 747, fill it with supplies from Boston area stores, and send it off to Saudi Arabia. John remembers thinking that it would be fitting if the plane were owned by the United Airlines and commanded by a certain pilot whose wife had played such a critical role in bringing the House of Saud around. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The deal between the United States and Saudi Arabia transformed the kingdom practically overnight. The goats were replaced by 200 bright yellow American trash compactor trucks, provided under a $200 million contract with Waste Management, Inc. In a similar fashion, every sector of the Saudi economy was modernized, from agriculture and energy to education and communications. As Thomas Lipman observed in 2003, quote, "Americans have reshaped a vast, bleak landscape of nomads' tents and farmers' mud huts in their own image, right down to Starbucks on the corner and the wheelchair-accessible ramps in the newest public buildings. Saudi Arabia today is a country of expressways, computers, air-conditioned malls filled with the same glossy shops found in prosperous American suburbs, elegant hotels, fast food restaurants, satellite television, up-to-date hospitals, high-rise office towers, and amusement parks featuring whirling rides." The plans they conceived in 1974 set a standard for future negotiations with oil-rich countries. In a way, Sama Jaipur was the next plateau after the one Kermit Roosevelt had established in Iran. It introduced an innovative level of sophistication to the arsenal of political economic weapons used by a new breed of soldiers for global empire. The Saudi Arabia money laundering affair and the Joint Commission also set new precedents for international jurisprudence. This was very evident in the case of Idi Amin. When the notorious Ugandan dictator went into exile in 1979, he was given asylum in Saudi Arabia. Although he was considered a murderous despot responsible for the deaths of between 100,000 and 300,000 people, he retired to a life of luxury, complete with cars and domestic servants provided by the House of Saud. The United States quietly objected but refused to press the issue for fear of undermining its arrangement with the Saudis. Amin whiled away his last years fishing and taking strolls on the beach. In 2003, he died in Jeddah, succumbing to kidney failure at the age of 80. More subtle and ultimately much more damaging was the role Saudi Arabia was allowed to play in financing international terrorism. The United States made no secret of its desire to have the House of Saud bankroll Osama bin Laden's Afghan war against the Soviet Union during the 1980s, and Riyadh and Washington together contributed an estimated $3.5 billion to the Mujahideen. However, U.S. and Saudi participation went far beyond this. In late 2003, U.S. News and World Report conducted an exhaustive study titled The Saudi Connection. The magazine reviewed thousands of pages of court records, U.S. and foreign intelligence reports, and other documents, and interviewed dozens of government officials and experts on terrorism and the Middle East. Its findings include the following. Quote, "The evidence was indisputable. Saudi Arabia, America's longtime ally and the world's largest oil producer, had somehow become, as a senior Treasury Department official put it, the epicenter of terrorist financing. Starting in the late 1980s, after the dual shocks of the Iranian Revolution and the Soviet war in Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia's quasi-official charities became the primary source of funds for the fast-growing jihad movement. in some 20 countries, the money was used to run parliamentary training camps, purchase weapons, and recruit new members. Saudi largesse encouraged U.S. officials to look the other way, some veteran intelligence officers say. Billions of dollars in contracts, grants, and salaries have gone to a broad range of former U.S. officials who had dealt with the Saudis, ambassadors, CIA station chiefs, even cabinet secretaries. Electronic intercepts of conversation implicated members of the royal family in backing not only Al-Qaeda, but also other terrorist groups. End quote. After the 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, more evidence emerged about the covert relationship between Washington and Riyadh. In October 2003, Vanity Fair magazine disclosed information that had not previously been made public in an in-depth report titled Saving the Saudis. The story that emerged about the relationship between the Bush family, the House of Saud, and the Bin Laden family did not surprise John. He knew that the relationships went back at least to the time of the Saudi Arabian money laundering affair, which began in 1974, and to George H.W. Bush's terms as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations from 1971 to 1973, and then as head of the CIA from 1979 to 1977. What surprised John was the fact that the truth had finally made the press. Vanity Fair concluded, quote, "The Bush family and the House of Saud, the two most powerful dynasties in the world, have had close personal, business, and political ties for more than 20 years. In the private sector, the Saudis supported Harkin Energy, a struggling oil company in which George W. Bush was an investor. Most recently, former President George H.W. Bush and his longtime ally, former Secretary of State James A. Baker III, have appeared before Saudis at fundraisers for the Carlyle Group, arguably the biggest private equity firm in the world. Today, former President Bush continues to serve as a senior advisor to the firm. Just days after 9/11, wealthy Saudi Arabians, including members of the Bin Laden family, were whisked out of the U.S. on private jets. No one will admit to clearing the flights, and the passengers weren't questioned. Did the Bush family's long relationship with the Saudis help make it happen?" End quote. Saudi Arabia made many careers. John's was already well on the way, but his successes in the Desert Kingdom certainly opened new doors for him. By 1977, he had built a small empire that included a staff of around 20 professionals headquartered in their Boston office and a stable of consultants from Maine's other departments and offices scattered across the globe. John had become the youngest partner in the firm's 100-year history. In addition to his title of chief economist, he was named manager of economics and regional planning. He was lecturing at Harvard and other venues, and newspapers were soliciting articles from him about current events. He owned a sailing yacht that was docked in Boston Harbor next to the historic battleship Constitution, Old Ironsides, renowned for subduing the Barbary pirates not long after the Revolutionary War. He was paid an excellent salary and had equity that promised to elevate him to the rarefied heights of millionaire well before he turned 40. True, his marriage had fallen apart, but he was spending time with beautiful and fascinating women on several continents. And I will continue the story in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.